That's the most bunch of bull poop I've ever heard.
Congressman Don Young takes aim at opponents of changes to federal predator control rules. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, February 14th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, state senators want to know how the state's Gasline Corporation is spending its money.
Mr. Meyer, I want you to know that there are people that I represent that are asking us to kill the project.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. Artists, show us how you inspire Alaska. Apply now for an individual artist award. Deadline is March 1st. Learn more at rasmussen.org/IAA. This message sponsored by Rasmussen Foundation.
The Yukon Quest has a winner, and as KUAC's Molly Reddig reports, Matt Hall, a 25-year-old Two River musher, had to overcome adversity and have a little luck along the way to arrive in Fairbanks first.
Here he comes. Come on, everybody.
Matt Hall mushed into a crowded finish chute and under a golden banner in downtown Fairbanks Tuesday, just in time for lunch. For the first time in 10 days, he didn't look tired. Neither did his 10 dogs. To get there, they had traveled nearly 1,000 miles together, through jumble ice, rocky summits, and 70-degree temperature swings. They passed the remote Yukon town where Hall grew up and the town where he lives today.
Welcome home, Matt Hall!
At 25 years old, Hall is the second youngest musher to win the Yukon Quest in its 34-year history. That's partly because he's been mushing since he was four. His parents have a homestead 6 miles downriver from Eagle, where they run a trap line and do dog tours. Hall was on a sled by age two and was driving his own dogs a couple years later. At the end of the chute were his parents, Wayne and Scarlett, with pride shining on their faces. They'd found someone to take care of their 50 dogs so they could fly to Fairbanks and see their son win.
Well, that was one of those things, you just gotta make it happen. Yeah, we had to make it happen. It was a close call, but we made it happen.
The Quest is a family tradition. His dad ran the race 3 times, and his mom has run the checkpoint in Eagle for 20-some years. Hall used to sleep in a box of t-shirts during race time.
He'd look out the windows till the team came, and then he'd race out and do whatever little chores they'd give him.
Hall learned to mush on the trapline trails of the Yukon River, and he wasn't always interested in racing. When he was a teenager, his dad recruited him to do 100-mile training runs.
And when it was over, he'd say, I'm never going to do this. I hate it. I'm not ever going to do this. And I said to him, well, when you run your first race, when it's over, you will do it. And he says, no, I'm not.
There was another family member waiting for him, too, a soft tricolor dog named Keeper, who Matt has built his entire team around. He dropped the 8-year-old dog in Dawson because he couldn't quite keep up and handed the team over to a lanky orange and white dog named Anchor, who led him to victory.
Everything he's seeing right now is a new adventure for him. And then his just with his mentality and his drive to be up there, that going together is just turning him into an incredible lead dog.
Hall beat 3 former Yukon Quest champions this year, making a big run in the middle of the race to take the lead. He was neck and neck with Eureka musher Brent Sass as they crossed from Canada into Alaska. But Sass scratched outside central when 2 dogs collapsed unexpectedly, leaving Hall alone at the front of the pack, 6 hours ahead of the next musher, which was quite a surprise for him.
I expected to, each year I've been running, this is my 4th quest now, to get a little closer and a little closer, but didn't expect a slingshot out front.
Hall said he was ready for lunch and eventually a long sleep. At the Yukon Quest finish in Fairbanks, I'm Molly Reddig.
A state agency today announced it is fining an oil and gas company that operates in Cook Inlet for major safety violations. The Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission is imposing a $446,000 penalty on Cook Inlet Energy for operating a well with failed safety valve systems. The valves prevent fluid from escaping an oil or gas well and can help guard against a blowout. The commission reports that in late 2013, a surface safety valve at one of the company's wells failed to work when tested. The company operated the well for 42 days despite the faulty valve. During a test a few months later, a different safety valve also failed. Cook Inlet Energy continued to operate the well for several weeks after that failed test as well. Cook Inlet Energy's parent company now operates under the name Glacier Oil and Gas. Glacier Oil and Gas CEO Carl Giesler says the company acknowledges the violations took place, but Giesler joined the company after the incidents and says Glacier is now under new leadership that prioritizes safety.
We're trying to play by not only the spirit, but frankly the letter of the law. The AOGC is trying to do their job, and we're trying to do ours in concert with them. And I think we've built a pretty decent track record. I'd say an enviable track record for the 2+ years that this management team has been in place.
Late last year, Cook Inlet Energy filed an application with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers to drill an exploration well in Cook Inlet. Giesler says the company is also completing 4 new production wells in Cook Inlet this spring. The state corporation charged with taking the lead on the massive Alaska natural gas project is again having its finances questioned. Today, members of the Senate Finance Committee pressed the corporation's president, Keith Meyer, for detailed information about his budget. Meyer has asked for legislative approval to shift millions between the corporation's 2 accounts. But Anchorage Republican Senator Anna McKinnon says the corporation has not been transparent about how the money has been spent so far.
What we've been trying to understand is whether you've been cross-pollinating those funds. And we haven't had access to any of the records to actually audit how you've handled those funds.
McKinnon and other members of the committee also quizzed Meyer over the costs of the corporation's satellite offices in Houston and Tokyo. Anchorage Republican Natasha von Imhoff asked about a $50,000 sponsorship of the Iditarod.
And how is sponsoring the Iditarod ceremonial start going to help you actually reach your goals of securing a buyer in Asia, obtaining a tax-exempt status from the IRS, and applying for FERC?
Meyer says the Iditarod sponsorship coincides with a summit the corporation is hosting that will bring potential customers to the state to see sites where the gas line could be constructed. Going forward, Meyer told the Finance Committee that the corporation would be more transparent, including sending regular updates to lawmakers to sign confidentiality agreements. He also says the corporation isn't planning to ask the legislature for any more money this year. McKinnon told Meyer that lawmakers needed more from the corporation.
Mr. Meyer, I want you to know that there are people that I represent that are asking us to kill the project, that are requesting information, and that they believe that it is not in the best interest of the state to move forward.
An ongoing audit of the corporation isn't expected to be finished until well after the legislature gavels out, but McKinnon says she'll have the corporation in front of her committee again this session. Republicans in the U.S. House are trying to roll back some of the environmental rules of the Obama administration, and today they turned their attention to a regulation that applies only in Alaska. The rule prohibits several methods of hunting predators in national wildlife refuges in the state. Amid talk of puppy killing, Alaska Congressman Don Young argued it's up to the state to manage wildlife populations. APRN Washington correspondent Liz Ruskin reports.
In a Rules Committee hearing, Democratic Congressman Jared Polis of Colorado cast himself as the defender of the Obama wildlife rule, and he painted the bill to repeal it in emotional terms.
This bill should really be called the Puppy Killing Act. What it does is it allows inhumane methods and cruel methods like killing wolf pups and their mothers in and near their dens.
And Polis says the repeal bill would open the door to shooting bears over bait and other practices he characterizes as inhumane. Young disagrees with that assessment.
So that's the most bunch of bull poop I've ever heard.
The Obama-era rule bans predator hunting practices that aren't broadly allowed in Alaska anyway. But the State Game Board says they're tools that can be deployed when needed to restore a balance between predator and prey species. Young says it should be up to the state.
We have to recognize this is not about the little polar bears and the little grizzly bears and the wolves that you're seeing on television. This is about the state's rights to manage, not allowing the federal government to do it.
Young also seemed to scold those who hold a romantic view of predators.
One year, on my trap line, the wolves killed 17 moose, cows with babies, ate nothing but the noses and the fetus out of the belly. That's your wolf.
His spokesman says Young ran a trap line for about 8 years along the Black River before he became a state legislator in 1967. Defenders of the Fish and Wildlife Service rule say the feds can't always defer to state hunting policies if they conflict with mandates in federal law, like their obligation to manage for biological diversity. The repeal measure now goes to the House floor. It's one of several attempts to use the Congressional Review Act to erase regulations the Obama administration imposed in its final months. The state of Alaska is also challenging the rule in federal court. Reporting from Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, studying how life returns after a volcanic eruption clears off a remote Alaska island.
We didn't know if there was a single living thing left on the island.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Anchorage and Fairbanks to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly. And by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, now distributing Boss Industrial Log Splitters, stocking gas and electric up to 34 ton, on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
There's an outbreak of a newly identified rare strain of Group A Streptococcus bacteria in Anchorage. It's mostly impacting people who are homeless. Public health workers will be visiting Brother Francis Shelter, Beans Cafe, and other shelters this week to distribute antibiotics and antiseptics to try to stop the spread of the disease. Alaska Public Media's Ann Hillman has more.
State epidemiologist Joe McLaughlin says the bacteria is fairly common. Most healthy people don't show any symptoms or just have mild skin or throat infections. But if a person's immune system is already compromised, then the bacteria can enter into a small cut and lead to major infections, toxic shock syndrome, or amputations.
The homeless population is at higher risk in general for these types of invasive diseases because they're at higher likelihood to have other chronic conditions. They also may have decreased access to care and decreased opportunities for self-care and personal hygiene.
The outbreak started in Fairbanks over the summer, then died down. It spread to Anchorage in the fall. There have been 7 to 10 severe cases per month since October. 90% of the patients were homeless. 4 people have died. Emily Masaitis is an Epidemic Intelligence Services Officer with the Center for Disease Control in Anchorage. She says this outbreak has been hard to stop because the disease spreads through human contact, like coughing near someone or touching. And it's impacting a very mobile population. But she stresses that most people should not worry.
The main thing to keep in mind here is that the risk for the general population is very low. Right now, we're still seeing it within the homeless population, and we're taking as many steps as we can to try to control it there.
The newest step is going to different service providers this week to hand out single-dose antibiotics and antiseptic washes. It'll kill the bacteria before it causes more severe infections. Mosaitis says the epidemiologists have been working with the clinic at Brother Francis Shelter since November to identify and treat cases early on and to contact people who could be at risk for infection. In Anchorage, I'm Ann Hillman.
A proposed bill would increase by 1,500% the fee Alaskans pay to the state when they buy studded tires. Alaska Public Media and KTOO's Andrew Kitchenman reports.
The rutted lanes on the Glen Highway in Anchorage's Eagle River section have helped prompt the new legislation. Anchorage Republican Senator Kathy Giesel drives on the highway each week to pick up her grandchildren.
The deep ruts there are a significant safety hazard. Cars get stuck in them during the winter, trying to change lanes, lose control. In the summer, they fill with water increasing the chance of hydroplaning and, again, losing control.
Giesel has identified studded tires as at least partially the culprit in causing the ruts. She's introduced Senate Bill 50, which would increase the state fee for studded tires from $5 per tire to $75 per tire. That's on top of a $2.50 fee for all new tires. Giesel says the money will help pay for road repairs, which can cost $1 million per mile on a two-lane highway. She sees it as a kind of user fee for drivers.
They can choose studded tires or the new technology tires. But if they're going to choose studded tires, which do result in the rutting of the roads, the damage to the roads, then we need to have some way to repair those roads for everyone's safety.
State records show about 50,000 studded tires were purchased or commercially installed in 2015. Alaska Department of Transportation and Public Facilities spokeswoman Shannon McCarthy says studded tires do cause more damage than winter tires that don't have studs.
The very fact that they're designed with a metal pin, that does take a chip out of the surface that they're driving on.
McCarthy notes that other things damage pavement, including vehicles' weight. That's why the state puts weight restrictions on roads when the ground is thawing. Alaska also limits use of studded tires from mid-September through April north of the 60th parallel and from October to mid-April south of the 60th parallel. The department recently started a research project with the University of Alaska Anchorage to look at the impact of studded tires in Alaska. A Washington State study found that studded tires perform slightly better in starts and stops than non-studded tires on smooth ice. But non-studded tires otherwise perform equal to or better than studded tires in winter driving conditions. A hearing date on the bill in the Senate Transportation Committee hasn't been announced. In Juneau, I'm Andrew Kitchenman.
Cass Atochi, a volcano near Adak, erupted for the first time in modern memory in 2008. As Zoe Sobel of Alaska's Energy Desk reports, that eruption has given scientists the opportunity to study how life returns after cataclysmic destruction.
Cass Atochi Island was an inactive volcano. It wasn't supposed to erupt.
That was one of the reasons why we picked it as a site to study seabirds each year.
That's Steve Delahanty. He manages the Alaska Maritime Wildlife Refuge, which includes Cass Atochi.
We went out and studied them each year for many years and had a tiny little primitive cabin on the island where people stayed.
Back in 2008, two biologists were living on Cass Atochi for the summer studying the island's auklet colony. In early August, they started feeling tremors. A few days later, the Alaska Volcano Observatory recommended they evacuate. The biologists escaped in a boat less than 30 minutes before the volcano violently erupted. Remember that cabin? It's vanished. The eruption also obliterated the rich ecosystem of Cass Atochi, burying the once lush island in feet of ash.
We didn't know if there was a single living thing left on the island.
Delahanty says there were no detailed studies in Alaska of how ecosystems respond to volcanic eruptions like Cass Atochi's. So the refuge formed a team of scientists, from geologists to biologists, to keep tabs on the island's recovery. Derek Sykes is part of that team. He's an entomologist. He studies bugs at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. He happened to visit Cass Atochi 2 months before the eruption. When he heard about the opportunity to go back, his first thought was drudgery. He didn't want to devote time to documenting a lifeless island.
I didn't really find the idea of hiking around a lot of mud and ash for years to be very appealing. You know, I expected there to be nothing interesting entomologically for a long time. I was, however, pleasantly surprised.
He took his first trip back about a year after the eruption, and he found life on the island, including bugs.
So there were definitely some survivors, but the plants were not numerous enough to support insect populations. So all of the insects were surviving off of matter on the beaches.
Organic matter like kelp, driftwood, and dead fish. And that was really interesting to Sykes because textbook ecology says new ecosystems start with plants, definitely not bugs. He did some research and found more exceptions to the rule, places like Mount St. Helens and Krakatoa, where melting glaciers reveal barren land primed to be recolonized, also had this unusual structure.
Cass Atochi became another chapter, another bit of evidence in this sort of exception to the rule that plants are always the first and most interesting things that establish in a new ecosystem.
Nearly a decade after the eruption, life is slowly returning to Kasatochi, but it still looks a lot like the moon. Sykes has found just as many types of bugs post-eruption as he found before, but he's documenting different species. He doesn't know if that's because his previous list was incomplete, because new bugs are hitching rides to Kasatochi, or some combination of both.
You know, we go back there every year, and we want to compare the growth of this ecosystem to other islands in the Aleutians, but no other island in the Aleutian has been studied as well as Kasatochi. We have, you know, our ignorance of the biodiversity is pretty large.
There's no going back in time. But with Boguslav Island erupting, Steve Delahanty says scientists have another opportunity to study life's return in a pristine natural laboratory.
I think what we can take from Kasatochi is an appreciation that even if it looks, the patches that might be filled with ash, for example, on Boguslav, aren't necessarily devoid of life, that this resilience of life may express itself on Boguslav as well.
That said, Delahanty cautions scientists won't know what's there until they can visit the island. Assuming it's safe, the Fish and Wildlife Service is planning a trip to Boguslav this summer. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Zoe Sobel in Unalaska.
Senator Lisa Murkowski wants to bolster the nation's volcano monitoring system. The bill introduced yesterday would modernize existing monitoring networks and create a 24/7 volcano watch office to keep an eye on active volcanoes across the country. Plus, it would create a connected system, the National Volcano Early Warning System, where information from the nation's five volcano observatories would live. A press release from the Senate Energy Committee says even though the Alaska Volcano Observatory is one of the busiest in the world, it has been underfunded for almost three decades. There is no estimate for how much the proposal might cost. This is the fourth time Murkowski has introduced legislation to enhance volcano monitoring, but none have become law. The current bill is also sponsored by senators from Washington State and Hawaii.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Anchorage and Fairbanks to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly. And by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, now distributing Boss industrial log splitters, stocking gas and electric up to 34 ton. On the web at arcticwirerope.com.
The Army Corps of Engineers is moving forward with plans to begin construction on an erosion mitigation project in South Central Alaska that's been in the works for nearly 20 years. The Peninsula Clarion reports the city of Kenai has been working with the Army Corps since 1999 on plans to halt erosion and prevent the loss of valuable residential and commercial property atop the bluff along the Kenai River. Kenai City Manager Paul Ostrander says a recent report includes several options the Army Corps could take for mitigating the erosion, with the preferred alternative involving the placement of protective rock at the bluff's base to stabilize the slope. The project is estimated to cost $30 million. Kenai is working to purchase the properties along the bluff to make way for construction. As people celebrate Valentine's Day, it's often interesting to see where their love comes from. You've heard of love at first sight, but what about love at first listen? KCAW's Emily Kwong has a story about one woman who found exactly that with the flip of the dial.
Vicki Wilson lives in Fairbanks. But in 1980, she was working in a state fish hatchery in Bristol Bay. Perched on the edge of a lake that would flash freeze in the winter, she was pretty far removed. No movies, no cell phones. The road out would often close. But there was one reliable tether to the outside world.
So the radio station, KDLG, in Dillingham, they were, you know, our news, our music, and everything. And so you got to know the voices.
And there was one voice in particular that drew her attention.
His name was Scott Dysett. He had an absolutely hilarious sense of humor. So, yeah, it was one of those things where it's like, you know, I really want to get to know this person.
It was like morning catnip, something that got her through breakfast and carried into the day at work.
The radio. radio was always on, and so kind of strong, comforting sound to actually hear that station and also to hear his voice giving you the news, the sad, the good, and the humor of it.
This infatuation with his voice went on for months. But in the pre-Facebook stalking age, that's about as much intel as Wilson could gather about the man behind the microphone.
And we didn't have phones at the hatchery to call or anything. So I asked one of the biologists that came out from town, what does this guy look like? And he says, well, he's not real tall, and he has a beard, wears glasses. And I'm like, oh, my God, you've just described every man in Dillingham.
Then one day, a year into her post, Wilson was baking in her apartment. It was a Saturday, close to Christmas. She got word that two men were crossing the frozen lake on snowmobiles. She wasn't in a hurry to come out and greet them, though, until a call came in through her intercom from one of her coworkers.
They told me, you're not going to believe it. You're not going to believe who's in the office. And they said, it's Scott Dysett. And I'm like, no. I quickly wrapped up the scones that I had just cooked, and then I headed down there. And it was, I walk in, and I was like, okay, there's a tall, there's a not so tall. And I just kept hoping. I hoped it was the guy with the blue snow machine pants on and the helmet.
The not tall one. And of course, his measured cadence was a dead giveaway. Scott liked Vicky's voice too, and early in their dating life, attempted to get her to record station IDs for KDLG.
You know, like, good morning, and or some type of sexy good morning, but I never was able to do a voice.
Which suited Vicky just fine.
And I still love his voice. He has a very pleasant voice, and frequently will read to me because I do enjoy his reading, and so his voice is just always a very consistent and comforting.
Scott and Vicky are celebrating their 35th wedding anniversary this year. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Emily Kwong.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Molly Reddig in Fairbanks, Zoe Sobel in Dutch Harbor, Rasha McChesney and Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, Emily Kwong in Sitka, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., and Ann Hillman and Elizabeth Harball in Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Eric Bork. Sean Dugan is our editor and producer. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station.
The Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta Subsistence Regional Advisory Council is meeting in Bethel February 15th and 16th at the AVCP Housing Authority Conference Room from 9 to 5 to develop proposals to change federal subsistence wildlife and trapping regulations for the 2018 to 2020 regulatory years and discuss other issues related to subsistence. The public is encouraged to participate either in person or by teleconference. For all the information about the meetings, go online to doi.gov/subsistence/regions or call 800-478-1456 or email subsistence@fws.gov. Contact the Office of Subsistence Management to receive meeting documents or to request special accommodation needs by 7 business days prior to the meeting. This message sponsored by the Office of Subsistence Management.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.